How important are your religious beliefs to who you are? I'm not just saying how important is it that you believe them, but what I'm wondering is how important they are to your identity. Do the people you know think of themselves according to their religious beliefs? Do they think of themselves primarily as a Christian or a Muslim or a Buddhist or a Sikh or something else? What about you? Does what you believe about God define who you are as a person? Now, it seems like Australians don't think that religious belief is actually very important to who they are at all. Earlier this year, the ABC asked 55,000 people almost 500 questions about their attitudes, experiences, and behaviours. And they've called this the Australian Talks National Survey. You might have seen some of the results that came out this week. Because the ABC is basically doing market research, they want to know what makes people tick. And if we're people who care about others, then it's good for us to understand what makes people think and how they think as well. One of the questions they asked is, how important would you say each of the following are to your sense of who you are? They listed 8 attributes. You can see them up there. Your political beliefs, your nationality, gender, language, job, sexual orientation, ethnicity, and your religious beliefs. As you can see, religious beliefs came in last by a long way. Australians are happy to find their identity in politics. They're happy to find their identity in their gender, their nationality, even the language they speak. But religious belief, not so much. Now, I don't know about you, but I'm actually not really that surprised by those results. More and more people consider themselves to be atheist or agnostic. Most Aussies think that they're secular, that their religious beliefs don't actually impact or affect their decision-making. And in fact, that their religious beliefs are so private that they shouldn't affect their decision-making. See, how many people have you heard who say something like, oh, well, I'm really glad that believing works for you. That's fine for you, and my lack of belief works for me. You can only say that, can't you, if you think that religious beliefs actually don't matter at all. If they're not, they're just a preference, that they're not worth talking about, that they don't make any difference. Now, a survey like this, we need to remember, this doesn't actually tell us what's actually true. But it does tell us what people think is true. It tells us what they believe, if you'll excuse the pun. How does the Bible tell us how we should see ourselves, though? Well, the Bible tells us that we are rebels without a cause, that we will do anything to dethrone God and go after everything and anything to avoid God as much as possible. The Bible tells us that God made us to be worshipping beings. Yes, even those of us who think that we don't worship anything, we all worship something. So we're either worshipping the living God of the Bible, or we'll find something, anything else to worship. G.K. Chesterton supposedly said, this is the quote everyone attributes to him, but you can't actually find it in his writings or in his lectures, but it's good nevertheless. He said, when we cease to worship God, we do not worship nothing, we worship anything. And it's so true, isn't it? That even those people who are around us, who surround us, who think that they don't worship anything, worship something. It's a question of not whether we worship, but a question of who or what we worship. Will you worship the living God of the Bible, or will you worship another God? Will you worship your job, money, sex, power, position? Or if nothing else, will you worship yourself? Now, why does this matter? Well, for a start, because the Bible tells us that what we worship, what we believe, our religious beliefs, actually changes how we live. That it isn't some religious belief isn't some alternate thing on the side. It's actually fundamental to who we are, because that's how God has designed us to be. And so you can see the clash between what the Bible says and what our world chooses to believe. But it's also important because if you look around us, we see that the world around us is broken. People hurt one another as they fight for whatever or whoever it is that they want to worship. People hurt one another. We fight. We feed on injustice. It's all around us and it's even in us. And so what do we do with this brokenness? Well, some people say, well, if religious belief doesn't matter at all, that can't be the solution. And so they either throw their arms into the air defeated, or some people just accept that our best is all we can do. It's good enough. It'll just have to do. And yet other people dream of fixing the problems we face. But to do that, we need to understand why we're broken, if you're going to have any chance of fixing it. See, if greed's the problem, then it can only be fixed if we make sure that everyone has enough. If poverty is the problem, then we just need to break the cycle. If ignorance is the problem, then it can be fixed with education. To find the right solution, we need to understand the problem. Now, we can find things that help. There's all kinds of techniques, policies, even governments that God has put in place to restrain evil in the world and help fix some of the brokenness. They're God's common grace to all of humanity. But if we really want to fix our brokenness, the Bible tells us that we need something much more radical. And that's rather than pushing our religious beliefs to the side, our religious beliefs actually have to be front and center. Now that is radical. It is a radical solution, but it's the only solution that will really work. The only solution that will really change us comes from us knowing God. And letting our religious beliefs rule over every other part of our identity and our lives. So I actually understand that our passage this morning isn't going to sound very popular. It's not very in vogue. But it's important for us to hear because it challenges this idea that our religious beliefs don't matter. That what we believe about God or the God that we don't think even exists or the God that we're indifferent to matters. Now, this message wasn't very popular in Hosea's day. The prophets were sent by God to call his people out, to in some ways name and shame them so that they would see themselves as they are. And so we should actually expect these words to rub up against us a little bit, even thousands of years later, as they continue to call us out today. Now, over the last couple of weeks, we've been listening to the words of God through the prophet Hosea. Hosea lived about 2,500 years ago, and God sent him to minister to the northern kingdom of Israel. And his job was to remind God's people of his faithful love. Now, the book of Hosea falls into two main sections. You get part one, which is all about living out God's faithful love. In that section, we saw the faithful husband and his unfaithful wife. Hosea's wife left him to go after chasing after other men. But God wanted Hosea to buy her back at great cost to himself and to love her still, even despite her sin. And he wanted him to do that because this remarkable act of love was actually founded on God's own love for his people. His people who had rejected him and gone off to pursue other gods. So part one is about living out God's faithful love. As Hosea lives it out, now he moves on to a section where he proclaims God's faithful love. The second half of the book is not so much a picture anymore, it's not so much a story of Hosea's life, but it's a series of messages that God gives. They're often called oracles, and they're kind of arguments made against the people of Israel. You'll also notice as you read through it that it's a bit like poetry reading through the remainder of the book. There's all this picture language that's used, and that makes it very hard to translate from Hebrew into English. So if you pick up different English translations of the Bible for these next chapters, you'll probably find that it feels at different times like they're saying completely different things. And that's just because the Hebrew, because of its kind of poetic picture nature, is actually really difficult to translate into English. So from time to time, you might sort of hear me making a point using a different Bible translation. It's because I think that it's the better one to go with. But as in Bible study, or as you read this in different versions of the Bible, just be aware of that. And I don't have evidence for this, but my hunch is also that this is a part of the Bible that hasn't had enough work done on it yet, and so kind of the English translations haven't actually kind of worked out yet what the best translation is necessarily. I think we can still pretty clearly get the main idea of what's going on, but it might pay to read a couple of different versions here. The big idea is that broken people need to know God. Broken people need to know God. That's the main idea. Our brokenness comes from not knowing God, chapter 4, verses 1 to 19. And our brokenness can only be healed by knowing God, chapter 5, 1, verse 6, 3. So in chapter 4, Hosea stops talking about his own story, and he begins talking more like we kind of used to prophets speaking, speaking the very words of God to his people. And it kind of opens, chapter 4, with a courtroom scene. God is the judge, he's the prosecutor, and he's bringing a charge against all the people who are living in the land of Israel. And the charge is basically this: how on earth can you get me, Yahweh, and Baal mixed up? How can you mix up two vastly different gods? Because we know that they were worshipping the Baals as Yahweh. Well, the only way you can get these gods mixed up is if you don't really know Yahweh at all. If you don't really know God. The problem is that they have not been listening to God's voice. And so he speaks to the Israelites and tells them, "You need to listen to me. Hear my voice," verse 1. Now, when he says that, he's talking to the faithful Israelites here. The true and faithful Israelites, but he's telling them to listen to him, but the charge is to a much bigger group. It's to everyone who is living in the land. And he throws the book at them. This is the charge: there is no faithfulness, no love, no acknowledgement of God in the land. God is saying, there is no recognition of me whatsoever. You do not know me. You're not committed to me. They don't love God. They don't even acknowledge him. That doesn't really sound a lot different, does it, to a lot of the people who filled out the ABC survey? Now, it wasn't that they intended this maliciously any more than it's intended maliciously today. But they, in their thinking, God wasn't really a big deal. Yahweh didn't matter. And so these people that he's speaking to and bringing this charge against are very much people like us and the people we rub shoulders with. And God's, I think Hosea has been clever here. He's saying that they need to listen to God's word as he speaks as a prophet. But more important than that, they need to listen to the word of the Lord. They need to listen to God's law. They need to listen to everything God says. See, interesting, everything that God said was at an all-time low, and he dares to say that this had dire consequences. Because when you stop listening to God, you stop living God's ways. When you stop loving God, you stop loving the things that he loves. When you stop loving God, you stop loving the world as he loves. When you don't know the truth, you're not going to live by it. God's people lacked chesed, this covenant faithfulness of God, because they had forgotten that God loves them. Remembering God, the way God treats them, is fundamental to them loving others. And he's so bold as to say that not knowing God has implications for the whole world, not just for people. It means that people will break the good boundaries that God has set up for them. That there's going to be social mayhem when people of all kinds of, do all kinds of nasty stuff together. And it's from forgetting God, not knowing him. I would even go as far as to assert that one of the first effects of not believing in God is that you lose your common sense. Now, most atheists, whether they're functional or self-proclaimed, are offended that someone would dare suggest that they don't live morally. And I can kind of understand why. You don't need to believe in God to do good things, do you? But what is the basis for those good things being good at all? Well, we just know, they say. But if it's that clear and obvious, why can't we actually agree about what is good for everyone? Why is it that countries fight? Why is it that people fight if we all agree on what the best and right thing is? Without a Lord, without a God who made the world and designed it, telling us how to live, then all we have to go on is what just works for us. And that might not work for other people. And so we're left with this problem that without God being our anchor and our grounding, then it actually affects the way we love and treat others. When we don't know him, we don't know how to treat others well. And it even affects the world that we live in, verse 3. God says that because of this, the land is going to dry up. Living things will waste away. It's going to affect the birds and the animals and the beasts and the birds and the fish. He's describing every realm of creation here. There's the animals that live in the sea, the animals that live on the land, and the animals that live in the sky. Every single one of them will be affected. Human beings were designed by God to rule over the creation under him. And when they forget God, that rule is affected and broken, and the world suffers because of it. Well, how do we get to this point? There's three W's that I want to give as subpoints under here, three W's. And the first one is wolves. Wolves. The first people that God blames are the wolves that are amongst God's people. They're the leaders who aren't teaching the right things to God's people. The reason God's people don't know God is because the priests aren't teaching them. They failed. He's blaming the leaders of Israel because they have failed in their role as teachers. They're given the privilege of teaching the things of God and they have blown it. They are walking disasters, not just for themselves, but actually they're a danger to others as well. They're blind guides who don't know whether it's day or night. They're stumbling around. They have no idea. And their so-called prophets aren't much better in Israel either, God says. And so God is going to destroy their mother. That sounds a bit odd, doesn't it? A bit harsh, perhaps. Not a Mother's Day address by any means. But remember in Hosea's book, the mother depicts the nation of Israel as a whole and focuses on the leaders of Israel in particular. That's kind of who Gomer was meant to represent in chapter 1. Not just the individual people, but the nation as the whole and the leaders in particular. Because they have forgotten God, God is going to destroy them. Judgment is coming. The priests have rejected the knowledge of God, and so now God is rejecting them. They've rejected God's law, and so they're going to be cut off. Verse 6, it's an important one. My people are destroyed from lack of knowledge. Because you have rejected knowledge, I also reject you as my priests. Because you ignore the law of your God, I will also ignore your children. God says, you don't know me, you don't understand me. You've cut yourself off from me, you're not listening to me, and therefore I am going to cut myself off from you. In fact, these priests, these wolves in sheep's clothing, to borrow a phrase from the New Testament, don't actually make things better when they teach God's people, they actually make it worse. They feed on the sins of their people, quite literally in all probability. They want their people to keep on sinning. Why? Because under Israel's system, whenever you sin, you have to come and bring a sacrifice to the temple. And so the priests literally got more food the more and more people sinned, and more they came to offer sacrifices for it. The more people sinned and worshipped, the better they dined. And so keep rolling it in, the priests were saying. They were more concerned about their stomachs than they were about God's people's spiritual health. So the first problem is that a lack of knowledge comes from wolves. And so therefore, friends, you need to be careful of your teachers. The people who teach and lead you, people like me. Be careful that we're not just out after our own gain, but instead lead you to the Lord Jesus Christ. Because when teachers lead you away from Jesus, then you're going to be led away from the Lord. Who leads you matters. Secondly, it causes problems with worship. A lack of knowledge on the part of the priests filters down to everyone, where it results in not just failed and broken worship, but perverted worship. And this has implications for everyone. Where we use the phrase, don't we, like father, like son. So much of what a parent believes is caught rather than taught. You know, as a parent, you kind of notice, oops, didn't teach the kids that, but they've picked it up anyway. Even the things that we don't want them to. Well, verse 9, it's a similar idea. God says, like people, like priests. The leaders aren't doing any better than the people they're following, and their people aren't doing well because of their leaders. No one's going to be okay, including the priests, because they're not leading people into knowledge of God. And so, instead of worshipping God, they've started to worship food and sex. And it's going to be their undoing. In Israel, the priesthood was meant to be passed down in the family. The role was passed from father to son, unless you don't have kids to pass it on to, which is what God is saying here. Your priests are doing such a dodgy job that I'm actually going to bring the priesthood to an end. They're not going to be fulfilled by what they eat either. See, haven't we always been there? Well, you have that meal that you're just looking forward to. Not necessarily anything fancy. Maybe it's just been a long day and you're looking forward to getting home to that great meal. And then you have it and it just doesn't actually make you feel the way you were hoping it would. It kind of leaves you feeling empty. Well, that's how God describes the Israelites' worship when they fail to know him. It leaves them feeling empty inside. But not only does it leave them feeling empty, it's actually worse because they've actually brought sexual prostitution in to their worship. They've started using shrine prostitutes in an effort to worship God. And they're left with not just the feeling of emptiness inside, but the feeling of disgust and at themselves as well. They've gone and done this with someone who's not their spouse. And it leaves them feeling empty. Because it's not an act of worship of the God of the Bible at all. It's a worship of themselves. And they turn to substances as well. They use wine and they are blinded by it. Rather than consulting the living God and what he has said, rather than knowing him, they follow after dumb pieces of wood. Pieces of wood that can't speak. Making fashioned idols out of wood. But it kind of even gets more perverse than that. Can you imagine walking along and asking your walking stick for an oracle? Your walking stick says, "Thus said the Lord." Well, that's what these people are doing, and you can stick it because it doesn't work. They're pursuing these other gods that are really no gods at all, and they're being led astray. They think that by making all kinds of sacrifices, that they will please God. They even do this temple prostitution in the name of religion, and it doesn't leave them satisfied. And because of it, God is going to punish them for their infidelity. But he's not just going to punish some people, he's going to punish all of them, you'll notice. You'll see in verse 14, I will not punish your daughters. It probably should be better translated, I will not punish only your daughters. God isn't going to say that he's going to punish all the women for going leading people astray. He's going to punish the blokes as well, because they are just as bad. They are the ones who are doing this as well. The men who consort with harlots and sacrifice with shrine prostitutes. Everyone is equally guilty. It affects all of them. And all of this behavior, which has been done in the name of worship, but instead it draws them towards ungodliness. Instead of leading them towards the Lord, it leads them astray. And so they're about to experience God's judgment, verse 9. I will punish both of them for their ways and repay them for their deeds. Our worship matters to God. Our religious beliefs matter to God. And he will hold us account to them. Now, the world doesn't hold us account to them. They think that we can just believe whatever we want, but it matters to God who we worship. He deserves our glory, but not only that, he calls us to worship him for our own good. And yet not knowing God has led them into false worship and into bad practices in their lives. The first W is walls, the second W is worship, the third W is warning. This is meant to be a warning for others. Now remember, Hosea was mostly sent to the northern kingdom of Israel, but his message wasn't just for them. It seems to be a warning for the people in the southern kingdom as well, for the people of Judah, that they need to watch out. When the kingdoms of Israel were divided, there was this massive split in worship as well. And God is telling the people in the southern kingdom of Israel to be careful about going and worshipping the way that the northern kingdom of Israel is worshipping. These people who are worshipping in the wrong places. Gilgal means that it was a place of worship. It literally means a circle of standing stones. And Beth-El, which literally means the house, sorry, Beit-El, which means the house of God, has been turned into Beit-Avan, which means house of wickedness. So they've gone from the, they've turned worship of God into the worship of wickedness. And so God's saying to Judah, as you look north to your cousins, be careful. Don't follow after them. Ephraim is comes up in these passages all the time. That's another name for the northern kingdom of Israel, because it's named after the biggest tribe there. And they've built this syncretistic religion where they've taken Baal worship and kind of pretended that it's worship of the true and living God. And they've kind of joined these kinds of worship together. And so God is sending them a warning letter to the south, saying, don't you fall to the same thing. We get an email from school from time to time warning us that there's chickenpox around. Because if chickenpox isn't dealt with carefully, what happens? It spreads. And that's what God's warning about happening here. If you're not careful about the religion that your northern cousins are doing, then it is going to infect you. They are going to lead you astray into their stubbornness. And you too will drink of my judgment. And so friends, we need to be careful of religion that's syncretistic as well. Kind of the religion that has this veneer of Christianity, that takes Christianity and mixes a whole heap of other ideas in as well. And we actually face it all the time. We kind of face this idea where people kind of Christianize other concepts. They kind of change and tweak the gospel a little bit. Be careful of going near to that, because that is the road to destruction. It leads us to dark places. It doesn't lead us into knowledge of God, but away from Him. There's all kinds of ecumenical movements that say, let's work together, let's find common ground. Let's worship God, whether it's He, she, or it, because we're all Christian. But we need to be careful of associating with that, lest we be led astray from knowing God and joining some kind of syncretistic religion that leads us away from biblical Christianity. We need to be careful of the kind of a Christian belief that takes a little bit of Bible and a big dose of the world. Sure, it's going to sound Christian. It might even smell Christian. They might even quote Bible verses, but be careful when there's a whole heap of other stuff mixed in as well. Now, that might seem harsh, but listen to what James warns us. You adulterous, James chapter 4, verse 4, you adulterous people, don't you know that friendship with the world means enmity against God? Therefore, anyone who chooses to be a friend of the world becomes an enemy of God. James puts it in two very stark categories here. You're either with the Lord, or if you mix in other things, you are against Him. So Hosea begins in chapter 4 by warning us that not knowing God is the cause of our brokenness. It's not knowing God that has led people astray. Our religious beliefs matter. How we respond to God, how we're led towards Him, how we worship Him, makes a difference to the way we live. And without Him, when we don't really know God, we're headed away from His ways and into His destruction. So what is the solution then? Well, our brokenness can only be healed by knowing God. Our brokenness can only be healed by knowing God, because healing can only come from Him. God tells them that they shouldn't think that this applies to everyone else. This applies to them. Verse 1 of chapter 5. Hear this, you priests. Pay attention, you Israelites. Listen, royal house. God is speaking to all of His people, and especially the leaders, and is warning them that that is a trap. Why are Mizpah and Mount Tabor mentioned? Because they were people, places in which God's people failed. In fact, in which God's people were allured into a trap. Mizpah is traditionally the place where Jephthah made his rash vow. And Tabor is the place where Deborah and Barak made infamous when Sisera was led into a trap and was nailed by God's judge. Be careful, God is saying. Be careful of where you are headed. Because rebels, those who rebel against God, are headed towards slaughter, and God will discipline them. There is a strong note of judgment that we can hear here. That they need to be caught, careful of being caught in a trap like a hapless bird or a beast. The Israelites were blaming their predicament on something other than their own actions, on something else. See, when we do things wrong, our first thought often is to think about who we can blame. But God says that's not the case at all. It is your own actions that have brought you to this place. At the national level, the government thought that it was security that was their problem. If they just beefed up their defences a little bit, then things would be all right. And this doesn't just apply to Israel, it applies to Judah as well. When actually the problem lay a lot closer to home. The problem is what's going on inside them. In fact, to the point that their deeds have stopped them from returning to God, verse 4. A spirit of prostitution is in the heart. They do not acknowledge the Lord. In fact, they cannot acknowledge the Lord because of their false worship. And it's seen in their arrogance. They actually think that they're incredibly godly, that they're doing the right thing. And yet their very arrogance speaks against them. They cause one another to stumble, and they stumble about in their sin. They think, though, that they can buy God off. That's why they take all the flocks out in verse 6 and their herds, because they can think that they can buy their way back into God's love. But you can't just buy God off. It's not just a matter of buying his favor. Apparently, that's what other gods want. If you make enough sacrifices, then the gods will do the right thing by you. But can you buy off the God of the Bible, the living God, with just some good deeds? No, you can't. You wouldn't be alone, though, if you think that God will be impressed by a little bit of money given to charity or the way that you help others out. But he's not at all. Our God doesn't want stuff. He doesn't want money. He wants our hearts. Unfaithfulness is the source of the problem, verse 7. Is our failure to listen to him that is the difficulty here? God just doesn't want a few meaningless sacrifices offered on his behalf. He wants hearts. And so God is basically saying, strap yourselves in, saddle up, boys, my judgment is coming. Sound the trumpet, raise the battle cry, because you're about to enter into battle and you are going to lose. Even though God's people are pretending that the problem doesn't lie with them. But God sees everything. Verse 3, nothing in heaven is hidden from him. And so he knows exactly how corrupt they are. Now we try to do the same thing, don't we? Andrew Freeman was telling us the other night about how in their shame and honor culture, something is only wrong if it's seen. Someone can be walking around in your shoes and you can say, hey, they're my shoes. And the person will say, what, did you see me take them? And if you haven't seen them, if no one saw you take them, then they have every right to take your shoes because no one saw. Now, we don't live in a shame honor culture. We believe in right and wrong. Those are my shoes. I paid for them. But there's a sense in which we all operate like we live in a shame and honour culture. There's things that we only do because we think that no one can see, don't we? There's things that we think we can get away with because no one else has seen us to bring shame upon us. The things that are done when we're alone in the dark or in the quiet times and places. But God sees. And so don't you think that you're going to escape my judgment, God says, because you think that I don't see, because I see everything. Nor do you think that you can escape just by moving the borders. That's what he talks about to the people of Judah. They think they're going to be able to escape God's judgment because they live south of the border. And if God's judgment comes on, they'll just move the border a little bit further south to make sure they escape. But the wave of God's judgment is coming, regardless of whether they move the borders. They're like the kid on the beach who thinks that they can protect their sandcastle by telling the waves, no, stop. It's a futile effort, isn't it? In fact, it's even ludicrous to try. It's a futile attempt to think that they can just move the boundaries and everything will be okay. Because God is like a moth nibbling at their clothes. He's like the rot that settles in. God's judgment might not be fast and swift. Sometimes it might be slow. You can't summarize what God's doing here any better than using the words of one of our former prime ministers. I want to do you slowly. That's kind of what God's saying here. Don't think that because I'm going to bring my judgment slowly that it is not going to happen. God is biding his time. But God's judgment is coming. Now, I once had an employee whom I was forced to sack because he just refused to do any work. He wouldn't do his job. And I gather from the fact that he came into the store later that day fuming, storming in and threw his shredded uniforms at me, that he was a little bit disgruntled about losing the job that he clearly didn't want. But his last words to me, and I'll never forget them, was, "You won't ever see me again, but you will hear from me." And so I wasn't surprised then when a couple of days later, the council food safety inspector turned up because an anonymous complaint had been made. We were all okay because we were doing stuff by the book, except all the stuff he hadn't done, of course, but I'd made up for that in the meantime. But the Israelites kind of think that just because they don't see God, they're going to be okay. But that's what God's saying here. You might not see me, but you're still going to hear from me. You might not see me coming wielding the sword, but judgment is coming. Judgment is coming, and in the end, we know from the history books that he used the nation of Assyria to do it. Now, at this point, it seems that God's people realized that they were in trouble. They realized that they were broken. They knew that they needed a solution. Now, if there's something strange in your neighborhood, if there's something weird that doesn't look good, who are you going to call? Well, they didn't call on the Baals. They'd already let them down and proved themselves to be useless. Instead, they call on the king of Assyria. Both Israel and Judah call out to a pagan king for help because they thought that their biggest problem was security. Backed into a corner, they thought their only hope was a military leader, verse 13. When Ephraim saw his sickness and Judah his sores, then Ephraim turned to Assyria and sent to the great king for help. But he is not able to cure you, not able to heal your sores. Now the word there is actually really, the idea in the image there is really graphic. This is an open wound oozing with pus. Today we would think that it needs intravenous antibiotics to heal, to have a begin to get the infection under control. And so when Ephraim realized the dire situation they're in, they turn for military help, but they've misdiagnosed the problem. In some ways, they actually would have been better off calling for Ghostbusters because this is a spiritual problem, not a physical problem. But they're dealing with someone much more powerful than a ghost, aren't they? They're on the receiving end of the living God, the God of hosts. See, giving people the wrong medication can actually make a sick person worse. When they saw this, they thought that they could get help from Assyria. This superpower, surely they could rely on that. But he can't offer them the cure that they need. It's not actually a problem of military strength at all. The problem is that they haven't turned to God. Now, the Israelites, they were trusting in military might, but I wonder what you and I put our trust in. Even if it's not at the moment, What is it that you trust when the pressure is on? Let me tell you some of mine. I sometimes trust that if I can only get through to Monday, then everything will be okay. If I just had 25 hours in the day, then I'd be able to get everything done. If we just moved house, then everything would be all right. What is it that you tell yourself would make everything to be all right? What is it that you tell yourself would give you hope, would make you happy, would mean that everything would be sweet and okay with the world? For Israel, it was military protection, but what is it for you? Whatever that is the idol that you have, the thing that you worship. For the Israelites, it wasn't going to help because God describes himself like a lion. A lion to Israel and Judah. He is going to come, and don't lose sight of the language there. He is going to tear them to pieces and carry them off. God is the one who is going to do the tearing. And so he is the only one who can heal. See, it might look like that Assyria is going to march in on them, but it is God who stands behind them. It is God who allowed it to happen. The only solution then is to acknowledge their guilt and to seek the Lord. Hosea starts to speak to the people more directly at the start of chapter 6. They need healing from God. Come, let us return to the Lord. He has torn us to pieces, but he will heal us. He has injured us, but he will bind up our wounds. Finally, there's the sight of a solution. It is their failing to follow God that has led them astray. And because of that, they brought God's judgment on themselves, but their only hope is to turn to God. True healing is only going to come from knowing the Lord, verse 3. Only he will provide the security that we need. And knowing him will bring the blessed relief of rain. That's the metaphor that he uses here. In a country that's desperately crying out for rain, how much our farmers and the people who are pretty much living anywhere but here are desperately looking for that rain to come. And what a relief we know it'll be when God sends it. But verse 2 really sticks out, doesn't it? It's kind of random. Some people have thought the image being used here is kind of a soldier who needs to recover after battle for a couple of days. After 2 days, he will revive us, and on the third day, he will restore us, that we may live in his presence. Where on earth does that verse come from, and what does it mean? Well, if you know what comes up later in the story of God's dealing with his people, you can't help but hear an allusion to Jesus here, can you? In 1 Corinthians chapter 15, verse 4, the Apostle Paul writes that Jesus was buried and that he was raised on the third day according to the Scriptures. Now, if you've ever done work on 1 Corinthians 15 before, you kind of go to 1 Corinthians 15 and you look up the cross references and you kind of think, where in the Old Testament where according to the Scriptures does it ever say that Jesus will be raised on the third day? Now, we don't actually know exactly what Paul had in mind when he wrote that. But no doubt the Corinthians had spent a fair bit of time as Paul had reasoned with them from the Scriptures about the Lord Jesus Christ. And my hunch is that at the very least, Hosea chapter 2 was probably one of the passages that he had in mind. I think this is looking forward to the time when Jesus will heal and after 3 days will restore. Jesus was crucified on the cross for sin. He hadn't done anything wrong that many deserved to be there. In fact, he had never done anything wrong, and yet there he stood, condemned to death. Why? Because we haven't got the ability to right our own wrongs. We can't heal the destruction that our sin has caused. We can't overcome the death and the consequences of God's judgment on us by ourselves. See, if you get the wrong antivenin for a snake bite, it can actually be dangerous. Most snakes affect either your blood or your nervous system. But there was a bit of a problem in Australia in the 1940s and 50s. People were being bitten by brown snakes and they were being given antivenins, and people would try the antivenin that worked for blood and it wouldn't save people. They tried the antivenin that was used for nervous systems, and that didn't work either. It wasn't until 1955 that a bloke named Ram Chandra just began milking the taipan and was able to make antivenin, because taipan venom actually does both. It kills both, it affects both your blood and your nervous system. So if you give the wrong antivenin, you only fix part of the problem. And so this was a massive problem, and all the experts of the day thought that those snakes, taipans, only appeared, were right in the far north of Queensland. So anyone who's bitten around Brisbane, that couldn't be the problem. And so it took a long while for this guy from the sticks to actually convince the medical establishment that they needed to do things differently. The cross is the only antidote for sin. Nothing else will work. Now, of course, we live in a world where the experts say, but that's the only thing that can't work. It looks like foolishness. How can God, dying on the cross, show us anything but weakness? And yet that is the one thing that can save us in our brokenness. Is the one thing that everyone assumes can't be the case. Is a God who, rather than being weak in dying on the cross, shows his great power to heal, that he dies taking our sin upon himself so that we can be forgiven, freed, and restored. Because Jesus didn't just die on the cross, but after 3 days he rose again, proving, showing, demonstrating that he has power over death. Many Aussies aren't the least bit interested in the Lord. They think they can live life without reference to him. Our religious beliefs don't matter, they say. And so they look for solutions in all the wrong places. But the only solution to our problem, the only true balm for our souls, comes from the Lord healing us. How many people think that they know God and yet don't believe in him? When you apply for a passport, you have to verify the picture. You need someone to say that that really is you. How many of us check whether our picture of God matches up to the picture of the Bible? To make sure that we are truly following the right God. To make sure that we know the God that we need to know to be saved. And not just some random that's picked off the street. So have you and God been introduced? Do you know him? Perhaps if you met him, you would like him. But if you're someone who has known him for a long time, do you today continue to trust in him as the one who can continue to fix your brokenness? That's Hosea's message in chapters 4 and 5. Let's pray. Our God in heaven, we thank you for the mercy that you have shown to us, the patience you have shown us. People who are hurt and broken, who desperately need a healer, thank you that you are that for us. Lord, please help us to know you better, more deeply and more truly, so that we might serve you and live in the glorious life that you have given us to live. So Lord, please be at work in us, reveal yourself to us, draw us out of our apathy, our sloth and our brokenness, for the praise and glory of your name. Amen.